The National Museum of African American History and Culture opened on the Mall in Washington, D.C. a month ago amid great anticipation and fanfare and to very positive reviews. The opening ended an effort that had begun a full century earlier. Our next guest is one of the driving forces behind that project. Judge Robert Wilkins is a member of the U.S. Court of Appeals for the D.C. Circuit. His admitted obsession led to the congressional authorization of the museum and the selection of its location. That, in turn, led to his writing a book about the project titled Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. And Judge Robert Wilkins joins us in studio, as I say. Thank you, sir, so much for being with us.
Thank you for having me, Don. It's a real pleasure.
Why did it take so long?
Well, James Baldwin said back in March of 1968 to Congress, my history contains the truth about America. It is going to be hard to teach it. And I think, as in many cases, James Baldwin put his finger right on it. It's a hard subject to tackle, the full scope and history of the African-American experience in this country. It portrays some of the perceived and actual hypocrisy of the founders when their talk of life, liberty, and pursuit of happiness while they are enslaving other human beings. And it's a hard subject to tackle, and I think it took a long time for the country to be mature enough and to be ready for this museum.
What was the turning point, do you think, in making this happen? Was it James Baldwin, or was it something earlier?
Well, you know, the inspiration 100 years ago was, you know, fighting the movie Birth of a Nation and really responding
at
the
turn of the 20th century.
At the turn of the 20th century. And there was always, you know, an effort to want to have African Americans be recognized and have, you know, a proper place in the historical context within the Smithsonian. The turning point came around 2000-2001 when it really became a sincere bipartisan effort to make this happen. And President Bush, who was just elected, was very supportive, and then Senator Sam Brownback of Kansas, and of course John Lewis of Georgia was the leader of the effort. But it really became a true bipartisan project. I call it the improbable, unstoppable coalition in my book. But they made it happen.
Mean there was actually a time of bipartisanship in Washington?
You know, I wanted to write about it because I think it, you know, we like to criticize when things aren't working, but, you know, let's give credit where credit is due. Here's a circumstance where, you know, people put principle above party politics and really came together to do what they all believe was the right thing. And they weren't fighting over, you know, who got to speak first or whose name would be first on the bill, all of those types of things. They really genuinely came together with this project.
But there were other obstacles along the way, needless to say.
Yes. I mean, along the way, you had the Great Depression as an obstacle. You know, Congress actually approved the equivalent of this museum in March of 1929. But it was a bad time to try to embark on a venture like this with the stock market crashing a few months later. You know, we even were set back by the September 11th attacks because there was a lot of momentum to approve this museum in early 2001. But, of course, those attacks diverted Congress's attention, rightly so, to other matters. So over the years, there were quite a few obstacles that the museum had to overcome.
Including the site, and I know you were actively involved in all of that, but as I understand it, the Smithsonian didn't really want to have very much to do with it at some point.
Well, you know, in the 60s and 70s and 80s, the Smithsonian really was not interested in creating an African-American museum. They appointed a committee in the around 1990 to study the issue. And the committee said that the Smithsonian should get behind it, and then they did get behind it then, but Congress wouldn't pass it in the 90s. And so when I got involved later on and around you know, the late 90s and 2000, the Smithsonian was kind of indifferent to this. Mm-hmm. And as I talk about in the book, There were some of their officials that were kind of behind the scenes opposing this. But once Congress approved it, to their credit, all of the leadership and the staff got behind it, and they did a tremendous job. And ultimately, you know, all's well that ends well.
I should point out, because our time is, of course, limited, that this history, your complete history, by the way, is something people can find in the book and should read it if they want to know about it. We can't discuss all of it, needless to say. But I'm curious about your obsession. What triggered your own obsession? That's a word I think you use.
Yes. I use the word obsessed to describe what developed. You know, it developed because I just heard a lot of stories of elders talking about growing up and fighting segregation and the changes in their lives and the things that they had seen on the occasion of sharing condolences after the death of a church member. And I said to my wife as we were driving home that night, why isn't there a museum to capture all of this? And as I began to look into it, I became more and more obsessed with wanting to see it happen.
Did it happen the way it was anticipated? In other words, in early projections as to what this museum would be, did it wind up being that, or did it evolve over a period of time?
You know, I think that people have had different ideas about this museum over the years, but I think, you know, what we have ended up with is pretty close to the original vision from 100 years ago. Back then, they conceived it as a national memorial building to Negro achievement and contributions to America. And I think that that's what this museum is. In some sense, it's a memorial as much as it is a museum. I think the architecture is stunning and beautiful, and just, you know, I think the timing with President Obama being in office as it opens, it really is to some degree a capstone of you know, African-American achievement, and really brings a great sense of pride to the African-American community, but I think to people of all backgrounds.
The building is striking. The building is absolutely striking, very, very different for that part of D.C., isn't it?
Yes. It's not your typical kind of white marble and right. Neoclassical building, but I think it fits nonetheless. It's a beautiful bronze-colored structure in the shape of an African corona crown.
Well, let's talk about what people will find when they visit the museum and go inside. I should point out, by the way, don't do it before March, because it's sold out, as I understand it, until at least March.
It's sold out, but, you know, I have friends coming in this weekend, and, you know, we're going to wait in line. They have some same-day tickets that are available. But the reaction has been amazing, and it's worth the wait. They're just – the history galleries are amazing. It begins, you know, at 1400 or so. Really to with an examination of what the global economy was like and how the slave trade evolved and began, and then, of course, focusing then on North America and the United States. And you really learn a lot from that, and, of course, it examines the American history and the development of the country and kind of the African-American role within that. As you move forward throughout towards the Civil War and Reconstruction and so forth.
Is it set up in such a way so that the first thing that you're confronted with that you see will be 1400? Is it a chronological situation?
So the way it's set up is that you can go downstairs, and they encourage you to go all the way down to the very bottom, and then you begin at 1400. And as you wind your way through – And up, you go chronologically until you kind of end with the present. And then above ground, there are galleries devoted to sports, music, theater, television, the fine arts, communities, and the Family Research Center and Genealogy Center. So there's a lot more above ground as well.
I've seen and heard interviews with people who have been through it. And I gather it can be an extraordinarily emotional experience. And I think we can probably figure out where and why. But why don't you tell us from your perspective?
Well, I mean, there's just some of the things that you see are so poignant. I mean, you know, shackles that are, you know, small enough for a toddler in thinking about, you know, someone actually wearing those and putting those on a small child. You know, a whip that was used by an overseer, and seeing seeing that and thinking about the torture and the pain that it inflicted. Seeing Emmett Till's casket and looking at, you know, the pictures from the funeral and thinking about, you know, this boy laying in who had been buried in there and what had happened to him. So, I mean, there's just so many things like that that really draw out a lot of emotion. And in fact, the architects designing the museum created a special room as you exit the history galleries with a water feature and a pool of water and benches there called the Contemplative Court for people to sit and meditate and reflect. And I've seen people just go into that room and hug each other and just you know, sob after, you know, reflecting on what they've seen.
What is the composition, the racial composition of people visiting the museum? Is it overwhelmingly African American or is it a good mix?
It's a pretty good mix. Yeah. I mean, I, you know, can't speak in exact figures,
sure.
but when I've been, it's been a very good mix, which I think is encouraging because, you know, the Smithsonian's motto is that this is a people's journey but a nation's story. This isn't a museum that's really just for blacks. It's a museum for everyone. It's a way to kind of really learn more about America from just the perspective of the African-American experience.
What about acquiring these artifacts and other things? You mentioned Emmett Till's casket. Generally, when someone is buried, the casket goes with them.
Yeah, that's a pretty amazing story. And I don't know all of the details, but somehow – there was a mix-up at the cemetery where the casket got exhumed, and then and Emmett Till was reburied in a different casket, and the casket was sitting in a warehouse, and somehow the museum was made aware of that, and they acquired it, you know. But people, they went around the country and did kind of like an antiques roadshow, and people brought things in, and they acquired things that way. People just called them up and said, you know, we have some materials from Harriet Tubman. Someone called the museum and said we have Nat Turner's Bible. Huh. So, you know, these things just kind of came from everywhere, just amazing things. And they did just a wonderful job collecting.
Well, some of those things must be priceless.
Oh, exactly.
Yeah.
And a lot of people just donated things that were very valuable because they really wanted – them to have a home, and they wanted the country to see them and to learn from them.
Are you making use of, I say you, is the museum making use of today's technology? I'm thinking in terms of interactive capabilities, that sort of thing, using visual graphic things that can be played with by visitors.
Yes, it's the museum is very multidimensional. It has, you know, some videos that are played along with, you know, where they have artifacts. They have some touch screen tables where you can interact and learn more about the things that you're seeing and read more about those things or see short videos about them. So it's great for young and old as far as that goes.
When you visit the museum, what strikes you most? Is there some place you go or a spot, one thing you want to see that you would go back and see again and again?
You know, I really enjoy going through and learning more about the history. And I enjoy just thinking about what people were, you know, what was going through their minds and really – trying to draw from the strength and the determination that people must have had to live through the circumstances that they did, or to be courageous enough to stand up and fight and oppose certain circumstances, you know, even with fear of death and retribution. And so I just am always amazed when I go through and see those stories.
How is the civil rights era, the 60s, handled in the museum?
Well, it's an important era of American history, and you know, there's a lot of important materials there about the March on Washington and various things that were happening in the 1960s, and you know, some of the issues that, you know, are being addressed with police violence and things of that nature. When you go through, you hear people, you know, remarking that, you know, it's interesting that, you know, some of those things during that time people are still protesting about now.
Well, I was going to say, how up to date is it? Because there's a lot going on right now that will certainly be in the history books.
Well, I think that the museum recognizes that, and I understand that the staff, you know, they're collecting things from protests that are happening now, and because, you know, in 10, 20 years, they may have an exhibit about it. So they kind of feel like, you know, it's a museum, but they're not living in the past. They're collecting now for the future as well.
How is all of this funded?
Well, the funding formula that Congress devised was half of the construction dollars would be paid for by the government, and then half would be raised privately. And so the museum has an advisory council that led the fundraising efforts, and they were very successful in raising the money. And then, of course, you know, the museum has an annual budget, and that comes from both Congress and from private funds.
To get it to where it is now, it was several hundred million dollars, I believe.
So I believe it was $540 million to construct that building.
Right. One of the things that caught my eye was an article in the Washington Post, your local newspaper, if you will, in which the headline was that Clarence Thomas, and you would certainly recognize that name being a jurist yourself, was snubbed by this museum, that he's not mentioned.
Well, I can't speak to that. I don't know whether there is nothing in the museum about Clarence Thomas.
There is about Anita Hill, from what I understand, and a mention perhaps of him in conjunction with that accusation.
Yeah, my understanding is that there's a part of the museum where I think it's called Making a Way Out of No Way, and it's about protests and social activism. Mm-hmm. And so there's mention of Anita Hill in the context of that. Yeah. But as far as, you know, reasoning why there's not more on Clarence Thomas, et cetera, I can't speak to that.
Well, do you think he should be there?
Well,
in some way, I mean, he is certainly a historic figure.
Well, he's a historic figure, and there's lots of historic figures that I think probably aren't covered in the museum because they can't cover all the historic figures. But I can't really, you know, speak to that.
Any oversights that you might mention that you think perhaps need to be corrected?
I think that the museum has done a pretty good job, and, you know, it's not really in my, you know, it's not really for me to say, you know, what they have included or that they didn't include that they should have. I think that it's easy to criticize these institutions and armchair quarterback them, and no museum can cover everything. And, you know, I think overall they've done a great job, and I'm not really interested in nitpicking with them.
Sure. No, I understand that. We have some representation in the museum from this area because Chuck Berry is represented there, as I understand it.
Yes. His Candy Apple Red Cadillac is in the music section. It's a beautiful vehicle, and I really enjoy the music section because – I enjoy music and just seeing the wide range of contributions that African Americans have made is really striking.
Mm-hmm. And in terms of bringing it up to the modern day, we only have a few seconds left. You mentioned show business and some of the entertainers and that sort of thing. Who was reflected there?
Oh, well, you know, it really talks about the change in African-Americans' perceptions and representations in television from the days of, you know, where you had Amos and Andy and the kind of stereotypical things to, you know, having Oprah Winfrey and Denzel Washington and others today. And so it's really pretty amazing to see how far we've come in that regard.
There's plenty of history there, and precious little of it has been taught in our schools over the century or two. That's something we should point out. I have to end it there. Judge Robert Wilkins, thank you so much for being with us. Congratulations on your hard work to bring this to reality. The book is Long Road to Hard Truth, the 100-year mission to create the National Museum of African American History and Culture. Thank you, sirs, for being with us.
Thank you.
We'll go out with a little Chuck Berry, but I'll tell you that archive versions of past St. Louis On the Air programs available for download or podcast at stlpublicradio.org/stlonair. St. Louis On the Air is a production of St. Louis Public Radio 90.7 KWMU. Thank you for listening. I'm Don Marsh.